This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are pleased to have Dr. Evan Levine with us. You're a practicing cardiologist. You're not a writer. You're not that kind of a researcher. You're not an investigative reporter. You're a doc. You've written What Your Doctor Won't or Can't Tell You, and I just get a phenomenal sense of outrage. I mean, I get the sense of, this is a guy who's, as they say in the movie Network, mad as hell and he ain't going to take it anymore.
Well,
is that what happened?
I guess so. You know, I'm a kid that comes from Brooklyn, New York. I don't like to get pushed around by bad people. That's the way I grew up. And I exactly right. I cannot take this anymore. I cannot take the idea of pulling into a parking lot in the community hospital where there are some very poor, bad physicians who are all driving the 500 Mercedes and pull up into the university hospitals where they've got the Corollas. You see the disparity here? The good doctors are being compensated less than the bad physicians.
Now, that's a very sweeping statement. Are you saying that all doctors who practice in community hospitals are bad doctors and that all doctors who drive big, expensive cars are bad doctors?
No, I'm not. But it bothers me that the duplicitous physicians are the ones that figured out the system and they're ripping the system off. There are excellent doctors at community hospitals. I do consultations at the community hospital. But we also have privileges at the university hospital. And again, if my patient gets sick, as much as this may put me in trouble here, I send the patient to a community hospital.
You also make a big deal about never, ever, ever get surgery without at least two and maybe three second and third and fourth opinions. Does that hold always?
No, absolutely not. First, you have to find a doctor that you put your trust in. And usually you will not need a second opinion, but if you're going to have a surgical procedure and your doctor tells you honestly when you sign on the dotted line or before you do that there's about a 5 or 10% risk, or even if there's a 1% risk, that you're going to die with this surgical procedure, why not get a second opinion? For all of you out there, have you on your exams since you were a child got 100% on every test 100% of the time? People are wrong sometimes. Why risk your life and trust that one doctor? Always get a second opinion for a surgical procedure. And honestly, I'd also get a second opinion if, God forbid, you have cancer and you're going to get chemotherapy. Another one. Always get a second opinion.
You use the magic word trust, which, having read through 200 and something pages, is, I will say, a little bit harder than it might have been before I started reading that. But you also go through in some detail and describe how to find, and really a lot of this comes down to finding and having a primary care physician and one that you can trust. And it turns out that the yellow pages and the advertisements on the nightly news are not adequate ways of finding those people.
Either the doctor or the hospital.
Or whatever other infomercial you may listen to. Let's face it, so someone advertises. They're looking for patients. They're looking to sell you some exercise machine or some hair growth tonic or whatever snake oil they can sell you. So why find a doctor that way? It makes no sense to me.
So how do you find a doctor?
First, I would always try to find a physician who accepts your insurance. After all, you're spending thousands of dollars a year on your health care. Try not to go out of network. And believe it or not, in that manual, in that huge HMO book, there are some very, very good physicians. So you need to realize that. Go to the HMO book, and here are some rules. First, we spoke about this. Make sure the doctor is board certified. Find out where he went to medical school. Find out if he has admitting privileges to hospitals. Some doctors don't even have admitting privileges to a hospital. Can you imagine that? And some doctors are now discouraged, even on the university level, this is a new thing, not to see their patients when the patient gets admitted. They have something new now called hospitalists, and this is also at a university hospital. When you get admitted, they discourage your doctor from coming in. This way, these are doctors that often work for the hospital, so the doctor can stay in the office Right, and that's why it's an assembly line theory here. It doesn't leave the office, can see more and more patients, doesn't have to go to the hospital. When you go to the hospital, there's a specialist called a hospitalist. Well, maybe that's good for getting your transmission done.
He knows his way around the floors.
He knows
where the bathroom is.
Exactly. But you know what? If I'm a patient and I found a great doctor and I know him for 15 years and I've been healthy, never had a problem in my life, and finally I get really sick and I end up in this behemoth hospital with 1,000 beds, 1,000,000 carters, and, you know, it's another world, and where's your doctor? Oh, he doesn't come here anymore. Hi, I'm so-and-so, I'm a hospitalist. You got to be kidding me.
And you can object to that, and you can leave the hospital, and you can insist on calling your doctor.
And you can leave your doctor. If your doctor doesn't admit to a hospital, if he's not going to come see you when you're sick, I would not see that physician.
You say something at the end of your book that I found, and it's appropriate to this. For the most part, there is no magic in medicine, just hands-on care and trying to do the best for your patient. And I think a lot of the challenge is we've come to expect magic, but partly because of the advertising, partly because of the mythos, the myth that has been created around medicine and the marketing that goes along with it, that we do have magic bullets. But the other, and I think that's a significant piece of what you're talking about, and part of the conflict between patients and the various institutions. But the other part of it is that personal piece. And that's precisely what you're talking about with respect to hospital.
Right.
We ain't meat.
It's incredible.
And it seems that what you're saying with respect to the hospital is you need somebody who understands you.
You need someone who knows you. You're in a foreign environment. It's pretty scary in a hospital. You've got lines in you. Maybe you're sedated. You might have a fever. You may not be yourself. You're asked to sign forms, go for studies. Where is the doctor that you've known for all those years?
Particularly if, as you describe it, the hospitals are more concerned about their bottom lines than they are about the health of the patients. And that is a statement you make, more or less blanket, about that institution.
The administrators today are considered good administrators if they balance the books.
In the hospital.
Amongst administrators, many of the hospitals are running in the red. If your hospital runs in the black, even though the food stinks, the services are terrible, many of the doctors have left, well, you're a great administrator. You see, I don't think medicine should be run that way.
Well, you also, there's another catch in this, and it's what makes it difficult for those of us who are not professional, and that is, well, we'll look at the numbers. We'll look at the mortality rates, and that will tell us. We'll look at the recovery rates, and that will tell us. But as
you
we
say
all,
it's not that straightforward.
But as we all know, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics, and the manipulation that goes on with that I found a little, disturbing.
Don't write it in the chart. As I mentioned in the book, I was called in once by one of the senior people at one of the hospitals to tell me, you can't write that in the chart. You can't write that your patient didn't get adequate care and that the intern did something inappropriate. Never write that in the chart. There are lawyers out there. The people are going to look. You're going to cause yourself more good, more bad than good. This is what's going on there.
Which brings us to another part of this puzzle.
Let me, before, what I found striking in that is that, as you describe it, and I may have this wrong, that somewhere, you know, before you pass to another stage in this sublime process of becoming a physician, that you sat in a class where they brought
before
in the lawyers and told you not to write things on
charts.
That's
right.
And the kinds of things were, this is substantive information that someone who is trying to care for, provide the best care, would need that information in order to provide that care.
You're right. You're told not to write any argumentative thing in the chart. That's a no-no because the hospitals, and there's some, you have to recognize they're a bit right sometimes. There's some truth to this. They're scared that they're going to get sued. Let's face it. There's a 1-800 sue your doctor, sue your hospital, sue everybody lawyer out there who can make a case out of any death or complication, even though it wasn't malpractice. So unfortunately, hospitals, doctors are working always with that on their mind.
You do say that there seems to be, we've forgotten, that life is finite and that medicine is a practice and that you can't necessarily get well from everything or live forever.
Right.
Where did we lose that?
I think we lost that in the 1-800 see your doctor ads. How many lawyers do we have in this country?
So and we bear some responsibility
absolutely.
For that, too.
You know, Mom died when she had the cardiac surgery, but the surgical mortality rate in the state is 2%, and this doctor had a mortality rate of 1%, but she died, so I'm going to hire this lawyer, and he's going to go through the chart, and he's going to harass the doctor, and maybe he'll settle out of court, or if not, he'll take him to court, and this is what you got to deal with, and it's terrible.
It seems that part of the challenge in this, though, and I'm not an apologist for lawyers necessarily, if all the other institutions who are supposed to be watching fail to do their job, it ends up with all the negative consequences that the one recourse that people have tends to be the law. Because if the if the medical societies, if the all those people are failing to do their job, it's not surprising that those of us who feel absolutely unprotected and don't know a great deal, having been failed by one profession, might be tempted to turn to another profession.
And that's an argument that many of the lawyers make. And let's face it, there are some egregious malpractice cases. And in my opinion, you know, I agree, there should be some malpractice cases. I write in the book of one case, I suggested that the patient go see a malpractice attorney. But again, life is finite, and there are lawyers out there playing games with all of us. And they are truly wolves in sheep's clothing. They come across as this great protector, but in fact, they're only out for the mighty buck. Who could advertise 1-800-SUE-YOUR-DOCTOR on the highways of America? Can you imagine that? Have you no decency?
Well, one doesn't have to imagine it. There's more to be said from Dr. Evan Levine here on The Paula Gordon Show. We'll be back in a minute. Be with us.